All right, how is everyone doing this wonderful morning? It's morning for me. Here it's 6:20 in the morning.
For me.
Today we are going to read chapter 3 of part 3 of 1984 by George Orwell. We're getting very close to the end of the book. And in chapter 2, Winston, poor Winston, was being tortured, reprogrammed through pain. And I guess we'll find out how that results, maybe in this chapter. This isn't just a reading of the chapter, but if you're watching this live with me, I want you to ask questions. What does that mean? What is that word? What does that phrase mean? I don't understand that. Because that's the whole point of this. We're supposed to stop and talk about the interesting words that we encounter. So, of course, I will, even if you don't ask questions, I will stop and explain things because I think it might be something that you would be interested in. So let's get started with chapter 3 of part 3 of 1984. There are three stages to your reintegration. To integrate something means to make it one with something else. So before, Winston was one with the party. He was integrated with the party. But then he left the party, and he started doing all of these things against the party. And now they're trying to reintegrate him, make him one with the party again. There are three stages in your reintegration, said O'Brien. There's learning, there's understanding, and there is acceptance. It is time for you to enter upon the second stage. As always, Winston was lying flat on his back, but of late his bonds were looser. They still held him to the bed, but he could move his knees a little, and could turn his head from side to side and raise his arms from the elbow. The dial also had grown to be less of a terror. He could evade the pangs if he was quick-witted enough. So to evade something is just like the word to avoid something. So he could avoid pain if he was quick-witted enough. To be witty is a type of being intelligent or smart, and to be quick-witted means to be very quick with ideas or words or answers. It was chiefly when he showed stupidity that O'Brien pulled the lever. Sometimes they got through a whole session without the use of the dial. He could not remember how many sessions there had been. The whole process seemed to stretch over a long, indefinite time, weeks, possibly, and the intervals between the sessions might sometimes have been days, and sometimes only an hour or two. As you lie there, said O'Brien, you have often wondered, you have even asked me, why the Ministry of Love should expend so much time and trouble on you. And when you were free, you were puzzled by what was essentially the same question. You could grasp the mechanics of the society you lived in, but not its underlying motives. Do you remember writing in your diary, I understand how, I do not understand why? It was when you thought about why that you doubted your own sanity. You have the book, Goldstein's book. Or part of it, at least. Did it tell you anything that you did not know already? You have read it? Said Winston. I wrote it. That is to say, I collaborated in writing it. No book is produced individually, as you know. Is it true what it says? As description, yes. The program it sets forth is nonsense. The secret accumulation of knowledge, a gradual spread of enlightenment, ultimately a proletarian rebellion, the overthrow of the party. You foresaw yourself, remember foresaw means predict, you foresaw yourself, that was what it would say. It is all nonsense. The proletarians will never revolt. Not in 1,000 years or 1,000,000. They cannot. I do not have to tell you the reason. You know it already. If you have ever cherished any dreams of violent insurrection, you must abandon them. To cherish something is to keep it close to your heart. So if you he's saying, if you ever cherished a rebellion, the idea of rebellion, if that is close in your heart, rebellion, you must abandon it. There's no way in which the party can be overthrown. The rule of the party is forever. Make that the starting point of your thoughts. He came closer to the bed. Forever, he repeated. And now let us go back to the question of how and why. You understand well enough how the party maintains itself in power. Now tell me why we cling, cling is hold very tightly, to power. What is our motive? Why should we want power? Go on, speak. He added as Winston remained silent. Nevertheless, Winston did not speak for another moment or two. A feeling of weariness. Weariness means feeling very tired, exhausted, tired of something. Had overwhelmed him, so he was tired of the whole interview, the whole process. The faint, mad gleam of enthusiasm had come back into O'Brien's face. And remember, gleam is like reflecting light. But O'Brien's face doesn't reflect light, but you can see light coming out of it, like he's excited about something. So that's why they use the word gleam here, a mad gleam of enthusiasm. Suddenly, O'Brien was very excited, and you could see it in his face as if it was light coming out. He knew in advance what O'Brien would say. The party did not seek power for its own ends, but only for the good of the majority. That it sought power because men in the mass were frail. Frail means weak. Cowardly creatures who could not endure liberty or face the truth. And must be ruled over and systematically deceived by others who were stronger than themselves. That the choice for mankind lay between freedom and happiness, and that for the great bulk of mankind happiness was better. That the party was the eternal guardian of the weak, a dedicated sect, doing evil that good might come sacrificing its own happiness to that of others. The terrible thing, thought Winston, the terrible thing was that when O'Brien said that this, he would believe it. You could see it in his face. O'Brien knew everything, 1,000 times better than Winston. He knew that the world was what the world was really like, in what degradation the mass of human beings lived, and by what lies and barbarities the party kept them there. He had understood it all, weighed it all, and it made no difference. All was justified by the ultimate purpose. What can you do, thought Winston, against the lunatic who is more intelligent than yourself, who gives you arguments, a fair herring, and then simply persists in his lunacy? You are ruling over us for our own good, he said feebly, and remember, feeble means weak. You believe that human beings are not fit to govern themselves, and therefore... He started and almost cried out. A pang of pain had shot through his body. O'Brien had pushed the lever of the dial up to 35. That was stupid, Winston. Stupid, he said. You should know better than to say a thing like that. He pulled the lever back and continued. Now, I will tell you the answer to my question. It is this. The party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We are not interested in the good of others. We are interested solely in power. Not wealth or luxury or long life or happiness, only power, pure power. What pure power means, you will understand presently. We are different from all the oligarchs of the past, in that we know what we are doing. all others, even those who resembled ourselves, were cowards and hypocrites. The German Nazis and Russian communists came very close to us in their methods, but they never had the courage to recognize their own motives. They pretended, perhaps they even believed, that they had seized power unwillingly and for a limited time, and that just around the corner there lay a paradise where human beings would be free and equal. We are not like that. We know that no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. So relinquish means letting go or releasing. He's saying, we know that nobody ever holds power and then thinks, oh, I'm going to relinquish, I'm going to release the power. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. The object of power is power. Now, do you begin to understand me? Winston was struck, and he had been struck before by the tiredness of O'Brien's face. When something strikes you, it's like a sudden idea. So Winston was struck. Struck can mean like hit. Winston was hit. That could be physically hit. But here what it's talking about is the idea suddenly comes to him. Winston, here he is being tortured on the bed, and O'Brien is playing with the dial, electrocuting him or whatever he's doing. And he's making this evil villain speech at the end of the book. And so Winston should be thinking about all of this, but the idea that hits him in the head, the idea that strikes him, is how tired O'Brien's face looks. So all these crazy things are happening, and all Winston can think about is, wow, he looks really tired. It was strong and fleshy and brutal. It was full of intelligence and sort of controlled passion before which he felt himself helpless. But it was tired. There were pouches under his eyes. Those are bags. I've got little bags. Bags are small, pouches are bigger. Bigger. I guess I just have bags. Maybe I've got pouches. I don't know. It was strong and fleshy and brutal, and it was full of intelligence and a sort of controlled passion before which he felt himself helpless. But it was tired. There were pouches under the eyes. The skin sagged. Sagging is when something should be tight, but it's loose, so it goes down like this. Let's see what kind of pictures we get if we look for the word sagging. I have to be careful because there are all kinds of things that could come up if you're looking for sagging. Okay, but what we have here, you can see these pants. You see, normally the pants are up high. And we would say these pants are sagging because they're up high and they should be tight, but they're low and hanging down. Do we see anything else with... All they show are sagging pants. Sometimes Google finishes your thought for you. No, just sagging. But that's what they show. But you can see a lot of... let me move that out of the way. Just in case. I don't want any kind of... A lot of things could be shown with sagging. And I don't really want to... I don't want to put that on a YouTube video. It's funny because all they want to show in this are pants. No, but for example, you could have sagging arms. You know, you expect it or you want it to be tight, but if it's hanging down like that, it's sagging. So I guess you get the idea of sagging. I think we can move on. Let me just readjust here. So let's read that again and see what was sagging. There were pouches under his eyes. The skin sagged from the cheekbones. So these are your cheekbones here, and the skin sagged. The skin, it should be like this. Well, hopefully, like this. But it was sagging. O'Brien leaned over him, deliberately bringing the worn face nearer. "You're thinking," he said, "that my face is old and tired. You're thinking that I talk of power, and yet I am not even able to prevent the decay of my own body. Can you not understand, Winston, that the individual is only a cell? The weariness, the weariness, tiredness of the cell is the vigor of the organism. Vigor is like energy. But let me just, I just want to check officially, just to make sure. I've been pretty wrong about my definitions recently, so I just want to be sure. Vigor, physical strength and good health. The weariness, the tiredness of the cell is the vigor of the organism. Do you die when you cut your fingernails? He turned away from the bed and began strolling up and down, one hand in his pocket. Strolling is like walking. "We are the priests of power," he said. "God is power. But at present, power is only a word so far as you are concerned. It is time for you to gather some idea of what power means." Gather can mean understand, but what it really means, like physically, when you gather something, you're taking something from different parts and bringing them together. So when you're gathering something, you're going here, you're collecting things from different places, and you're bringing it all close to you. So when you say, "I gather," like "I understand" or "I observe," it could mean observe also. It means you're taking little pieces from things that you see and you're bringing it to you and making a conclusion from that. How did he use gather here? "It is time for you to gather some idea of what power means." So it kind of means observe, but it sounds like he's going to explain several things or show him several things. And from those several things, Winston will come to an understanding of what power means. "The first thing that you must realize is that power is collective. The individual only has power insofar as he ceases to be an individual. You know the party slogan, 'Freedom is slavery.' Has it ever occurred to you that it is reversible? Slavery is freedom? Alone, free, the human being is always defeated. It must be so, because every human being is doomed to die. To be doomed or to experience doom is to experience a horrible end. So every human has the horrible end of dying. Every human being is doomed to die, which is the greatest of all failures. But if he can make a complete and utter submission, if he can escape from his identity, if he can merge himself in the party so that he is the party, then he is all-powerful and immortal. Second thing for you to realize is that power is power over human beings, over the body, but above all, over the mind, power over matter, external reality, as you would call it. It's not important. Already, our control over matter is absolute." For a moment, Winston ignored the dial. He made a violent effort to raise himself into a sitting position and merely succeeded in wrenching his body painfully. "But how can you control matter?" he burst out. "You don't even control the climate or the law of gravity. And there are disease, pain, death." O'Brien silenced him by the movement of his hand. "We control matter because we control the mind. Reality is inside the skull. You will learn by degrees, Winston. There is nothing that we could not do. Invisibility, levitation, anything. I could float off the floor like a soap bubble if I wished to. I do not wish to, because the party does not wish it. You must get rid of those 19th century ideas about the laws of nature. We make the laws of nature. But you do not. You are not even masters of this planet. What about Eurasia and East Asia? You have not conquered them yet. Unimportant. We shall conquer them when it suits us. And if we did not, what difference would it make? We can shut them out of existence. Oceania is the world. But the world itself is only a speck of dust, and man is tiny, helpless. How long have you been in existence? For 1,000,000 years, the Earth was uninhabited. Nonsense. The Earth is as old as we are. No older. How could it be older? Nothing exists, except through human consciousness. But the rocks are full of the bones of extinct animals, mammoths, and mastodons, and enormous reptiles, which lived there long before man was ever heard of. Have you ever seen those bones, Winston? Of course not. 19th century biologists invented them. Before man, there was nothing. After man, if he could come to an end, there would be nothing. Outside of man, there is nothing. But the whole universe is outside of us. Look at the stars. Some of them are 1,000,000 light years away. They are out of reach forever. What are the stars? Said O'Brien indifferently. They're bits of fire a few kilometers away. We could reach them if we wanted to, or we could blot them out. To blot something... Well, let's see if we can find a picture of a blot. It's like a stain. These are blots. So it's kind of it's like the shape of a stain. And a lot of times when you think about the word blot, you think about ink from a pen, because old pens used to do this all the time. So that's what a blot is. It's this kind of shape, kind of a blurry stain shape. To blot something out means to cover it. So if you're saying we could blot out the stars, it means we could put something over the stars like this. And you wouldn't see the stars anymore. To blot something out means to cover it so that you can't see it. We could reach them if we wanted to, or we could blot them out. The Earth is the center of the universe. The sun and the stars go round it. Winston made another convulsive movement. This time he did not say anything. O'Brien continued, as though answering a spoken objection. For certain purposes, of course, that is not true. When we navigate the ocean, or when we predict an eclipse, we often find it convenient to assume that the Earth goes round the sun, and that the stars are millions upon millions of kilometers away. But what of it? Saying what of it means like, but who cares? But so what? Who cares? Do you suppose it is beyond us to produce a dual system of astronomy? The stars can be near or distant according to as we need them. Do you suppose our mathematicians are unequal to that? Have you forgotten doublethink? Winston shrank back to the bed. Shrinking means becoming smaller. So if you're afraid somebody's going to hurt you, or if you're ashamed and you feel bad or something like that, you might shrink. You might make yourself smaller. Whatever he said, the swift answer crushed him like a bludgeon. And yet he knew that he was in the right. The belief that nothing exists outside your own mind, surely there must be some way of demonstrating it was false. Had it not been exposed long ago as a fallacy? There was even a name for it, which he had forgotten. A faint smile twitched the corner of O'Brien's mouth. A twitch is like a quick movement. I don't know if you can see me. It's just a quick movement, a very quick movement. Have you ever had a situation where your eye was doing this, like moving? Sometimes that happens to me. That makes me crazy. What you would say is my eye is twitching. That's a twitch. Now, here in the story, it says a faint smile twitched the corners of O'Brien's mouth, which means he did it very quickly. As he looked down at him, it was very small and very quick. "I told you, Winston," he said, "that metaphysics is not your strong point. The word you're trying to think of is solipsism. I've heard that word before, but I can't remember what it means. Let's look up solipsism. The quality of being very... Okay, that's not... We want the philosophic... The viewer theory that the self is all that can be known to exist. So it's a philosophical belief that the only thing possible to really know is that your own self exists. Okay, but you're mistaken. This is not solipsism, collective solipsism, if you like. But that is a different thing. In fact, the opposite thing. All this is a digression. A digression is like a distraction or a detour. So it's like changing the subject. So he's saying, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking about the word solipsism. But this, you know, he starts changing the subject and he says, but this is a digression. We're changing the subject. Let's return to my point. The real power, the power we have to fight for night and day, is not power over things, but over men. He paused and for a moment assumed again his air of a schoolmaster questioning a promising pupil. How does one man assert his power over another, Winston? Winston thought. By making him suffer, he said. Exactly. By making him suffer. Obedience is not enough unless he is suffering. How can you be sure that he is obeying your will and not his own? Power is in inflicting pain and humiliation. Power is in tearing human minds to pieces and putting them together again in new shapes of your own choosing. Wow, that sounds like what they're doing now. Do you begin to see, then, what kind of world we are creating? It is the exact opposite of the stupid hedonistic utopias that the old reformers imagined. So, a utopia, I think we've used that word, it's like the ideal society, the ideal place to live is a utopia. And hedonistic means like pleasure-seeking. Let's just check that definition, hedonistic. These are not terribly important words to know. Pursuit of pleasure, sensual, self-indulgent. So a hedonistic utopia is the ideal society where everybody just always experiences pleasure. A world of fear and treachery and torment, a world of trampling and being trampled upon, a world which will grow not less but more merciless as it refines itself. Progress in our world will be progress towards more pain. The old civilizations claimed that they were founded on love or justice. Ours is founded upon hatred. In our world, there will be no emotions except for fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. Everything else we shall destroy. Everything. Already we are breaking down the habits of thought which have survived from before the revolution. We have cut the links between child and parent, between man and man, and between man and woman. No one dares trust a wife or a child or a friend any longer. But in the future there will be no wives and no friends. Children will be taken from their mothers at birth, as one takes eggs from a hen. The sex instinct will be eradicated. Procreation will be an annual formality like the renewal of a ration card. We shall abolish the orgasm. Our neurologists are at work upon it now. There will be no loyalty except loyalty towards the party. There will be no love except the love of Big Brother. There will be no laughter except the laugh of triumph over a defeated enemy. There will be no art, no literature, no science. When we are omnipotent, we shall have no more need of science. Omnipotent means all powerful. If I can say it, omnipotent. So when we are all powerful, let me just check. I better check. Omnipotent. Yeah, having unlimited power. When we are omnipotent, we shall have no need for science. When we are all powerful, when we have all of the power, there will be no need for science. There will be no distinction between beauty and ugliness. There will be no curiosity, no enjoyment of the process of life. All competing pleasures will be destroyed. But always, do not forget this, Winston, always there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler. Subtle means difficult to notice or difficult to see. So when he says there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler, it means this intoxication of power will become maybe so common or so expected that it will be difficult to see the ways in which it shows itself. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, and the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. He paused, as though he expected Winston to speak. Winston had tried to shrink back into the surface of the bed again. He could not say anything. His heart seemed to be frozen. O'Brien went on. And remember that it is forever. The face will always be there to be stamped upon. The heretic, the enemy of society, will always be there, so that he can be defeated and humiliated over again. Everything that you have undergone, since you have been in our hands, all that will continue. And worse, the espionage, the betrayals, the arrests, the tortures, the executions, the disappearances will never cease. It will be a world of terror as much as a world of triumph. The more the party is powerful, the less it will be tolerant, the weaker the opposition, the tighter the despotism. Goldstein and his heresies will live forever. Every day, at every moment, they will be defeated, discredited, ridiculed, spat upon. Spat is pff, so spit, spat, spat, pff, spat upon. And yet they will always survive. This drama that I have played out with you during 7 years will be played out over and over again, generation after generation, always in subtler forms. Remember, subtle means difficult to detect or difficult to see or difficult to notice. So it won't be so obvious. Maybe right now it's kind of obvious what they're doing, but they'll get better at it, and then it will become more subtle and difficult to notice. But it will still be there. Always we shall have the heretic hair at our mercy, screaming with pain, broken up, contemptible, and in the end, utterly penitent. Contemptible means easy to hate. And penitent means, I'm sorry, please forgive me. It means genuinely feeling very sorry and looking for forgiveness. Saved from himself, crawling to our feet of his own accord. This is the world that we are preparing, Winston, a world of victory after victory, triumph after triumph after triumph. an endless pressing upon the nerve of power. Oh, hi, Hadi. How are you doing? I didn't see you writing here. I just noticed that now. Wait, why didn't I see that earlier? Oh, because I don't have my message window open. I'm sorry. Wait, let me see. To live in reverie. Well, reverie kind of means like happiness, celebration. Wait, let's check the definition here. Reverie. Well, it just says a state of being pleasantly lost in one's thought and a daydream. That's funny because it's not how I picture the word reverie. But, no, I guess, I mean, according to the definition, if you look at the definition, and again, reverie, I don't think is an extremely common word, but it says being pleasantly lost in one's thoughts or daydreams. But a utopia is like an ideal society. It's like the society, let's see, utopia. Let's just check the definition. An imaginary community or society that possesses highly desirable or near perfect qualities for its members. So, you know, sometimes there could be like a group of religious people who say, we hate everyone, we want to live in our own religious community and, you know, live our ideal religious life. And this would be like a religious utopia. Or the Soviet Union, they were trying to build the ideal communist society. And so you could call that a communist utopia. So it's this idea of like the highest principles of some kind of philosophy, like a religion or a political idea, and people trying to live that, which I think is probably unobtainable because nothing is perfect, and a utopia is supposed to be a sort of perfect place. Let's see, penitent remorse. Yeah, I think the difference between penitent and remorse, though, is that when you're penitent, you're showing it to people because you want forgiveness. But let me check. I don't know if you're still here because I'm just seeing your messages now. Penitent. What is going on here? Yeah, so when you're penitent, it's like you're asking for forgiveness. You're sorry and you're asking for forgiveness. But when you feel remorse, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're looking for people to forgive you. You just feel very bad about it, if that makes any sense. Okay. A world of victory after victory, triumph after triumph after triumph, an endless pressing upon the nerve of power. You are beginning, I can see, to realize that what the world will be like, but in the end, you will do more than understand it. You will accept it, welcome it, and become part of it. Winston had recovered himself sufficiently to speak. You can't, he said weakly. What do you mean by that remark, Winston? You could not create such a world as you have just described. It's a dream. It's impossible. So Winston is saying it's a utopia. You know, this is an ideal. This is your perfect world, but nothing is perfect. So you can't achieve that. Why? It's impossible to found a civilization on fear and hatred and cruelty. It would never endure. Why not? It would have no vitality. It would disintegrate. It would commit suicide. Nonsense. You're under the impression that hatred is more exhausting than love. Why should it be? And if it were, what difference would it make? Suppose that we choose to wear ourselves out faster. Suppose that we quicken the tempo of human life till men are senile at 30. Still, what difference would it make? Can you not understand that the death of the individual is not death? The party is immortal. As usual, the voice had battered Winston into helplessness. Moreover, he was in dread that if he persisted in his disagreement, O'Brien would twist the dial again, and yet he could not keep silent. Feebly, which means weakly, without arguments, with nothing to support him except his inarticulate horror of what Brian had said, he returned to the attack. To be articulate means that you express your ideas very clearly. So if you're being inarticulate, that means that you are not expressing your ideas very clearly. And of course, Winston has to be inarticulate because they're torturing him. He can hardly talk. So it's not easy for him to have a conversation about these very complicated ideas because of the circumstances. So he's being very inarticulate. He's not expressing his ideas very well. I don't know, I don't care, somehow you will fail. Something will defeat you. Life will defeat you. We control life, Winston, at all its levels. You are imagining that there is something called human nature which will be outraged by what we do and will turn against us. But we create human nature. Men are infinitely malleable. To be malleable means that you can shape it. You can change the shape of it. And when he says that men are infinitely malleable, it means you can take a person and you can reshape them. And because he says infinitely, it means you can do that as many times as you want. It doesn't matter. It's very easy to do. Well, maybe not easy, but it's very possible to do infinitely, forever. Or perhaps you have returned to your old idea that the proletarians or the slaves will arise and overthrow us. Put it out of your mind. They're helpless, like the animals. Humanity is the party. The others are outside, irrelevant. Hadi asks, malleable, pliable, pliant. Let me just check the word pliant. I don't know, for some reason when I think of the word ply, I just think of one kind of motion, but let me see. To ply. To work with or at diligently, employ busily, ply the needle. Let's see. Let's look at pliable. Easy to bend, flexible. Well, I think the difference between... Well, let's look at a picture for a minute, okay? Because pliable is about something being flexible in the sense of... Well, let's see. I'm trying to find a good picture here. Of bending, mostly. Like, for example, this is kind of an interesting shelf. You could kind of bend the shelf. So when you're saying pliable, it could mostly mean something like that, something that you could bend easily. It's easy to bend. But when you talk about malleable, that's like to shape. So let's see if we can find something malleable. Can you see these pictures? Like this. This is very malleable. You see the difference between pliable, or what the difference could be between pliable and malleable? Malleable is like changing the entire shape or form. But pliable could mean it's just easy to move it in this way. They are helpless, like the animals. Humanity is the party. The others are outside. Irrelevant. I don't care. In the end, they will beat you sooner or later. They will see you for what you are, and then they will tear you to pieces. Do you see any evidence of this happening, or any reason why it should? No, I believe it. I know that you will fail. There is something in the universe, I don't know, some spirit, some principle that you will never overcome. To overcome something means to win over it or to defeat it. So there's some principle that you will never win over, you will never defeat. Do you believe in God, Winston? No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know, the spirit of man. And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man. Your kind is extinct. We are the inheritors. Do you understand that you're alone? You're outside history. You are non-existent. His manner changed, and he seemed more harshly. He said more harshly, and do you consider yourself morally superior to us with our lies and our cruelty? Yes. I consider myself superior. O'Brien did not speak. Two other voices were speaking. After a moment, Winston recognized one of them as his own. It was a soundtrack of the conversation he had had with O'Brien on the night when he had enrolled himself in the Brotherhood. He heard himself promising to lie, to steal, to forge, to murder, to encourage drug-taking, prostitution, to disseminate venereal diseases, to throw vitriol in a child's face. O'Brien made a small, impatient gesture as though to say that the demonstration was hardly worth making. And then he turned a switch, and the voices stopped. "Get up from the bed," he said. The bonds had loosened themselves. Winston lowered himself to the floor and stood up unsteadily. "You are the last man," said O'Brien. "You are the guardian of the human spirit. You shall see yourself as you are. Take off your clothes." Winston undid the bit of string that held his overalls together. The zip fastener had long since been wrenched out of them. He could not remember whether at any time since his arrest he had taken off all his clothes at one time. Beneath the overalls, his body was looped with filthy, yellowish rags, just recognizable as the remnants of underclothes. As he slid them to the ground, he saw that there was a three-sided mirror at the far end of the room. He approached it and then stopped short. An involuntary cry had broken out of him. "Go on," said O'Brien. "Stand between the wings of the mirror. You shall see the side view as well." He had stopped because he was frightened. A bowed, gray-colored skeleton-like thing was coming towards him. Its actual appearance was frightening, and not merely the fact that he knew it to be himself. He moved closer to the glass. The creature's face seemed to be protruded because of its bent carriage, a forlorn jailbird's face with a knobby forehead running back into a bald scalp. Forlorn means, forsaken means abandoned, but I would say that forlorn also means abandoned. I just want to see what's the difference between forsake and forlorn. Because I was about to say forlorn means abandoned, but that's forsake. So let's see what the difference is. They both mean abandonment, but the difference is that forlorn is because you deserted something or neglected something or something is alone and isolated. It can also be used to talk about a sense of hopelessness or despair. But forsake... Oh, and forlorn is an adjective. So if someone looks forlorn, they look abandoned. They look very pathetic and sad and neglected and deserted. And forsake is a verb, which you can use to mean abandoned. The verb means to abandon, desert, or renounce something or someone, often with a sense of finality or permanence, like abandon forever. Okay. So, but it does mean abandoned, but it's used mostly like an adjective. A forlorn jail... And now it's funny, when somebody is sent to prison, or when they're sent to prison repeatedly, kind of a funny word for criminal, you can call them a jailbird. So he says, a forlorn jailbird's face. So he looked like an abandoned, pathetic person who has spent a great deal of time in jail. With a knobby forehead running back into a bald scalp, and a crooked nose and battered-looking cheekbones, above which his eyes were fierce and watchful. The cheeks were seamed. The mouth had a drawn-in look. Certainly, it was his own face, but it seemed to him that it had changed more than he had changed inside. The emotions it registered would be different from the ones he felt. He had gone partially bald. For the first moment, he had thought that he had gone gray as well. But it was only the scalp that was gray, except his hands and circles of his face. His body was gray all over with ancient, ingrained dirt. Here and there, under the dirt, there were red scars of wounds. And near the ankle, the varicose ulcer that was an inflamed mass with flakes of skin peeling off it. But the truly frightening thing was the emaciation of his body. When you're emaciated, that means like you can see the bones of the body because you haven't eaten for a long time. So an emaciated person is someone where you can actually see their bones through the skin. Not see the bones, but you can see the shape of the bones through the skin. The barrel of ribs was as narrow as that of a skeleton. The legs had shrunk so that the knees were thicker than the thighs. He saw now what O'Brien had meant about seeing the side view. The curvature of the spine was astonishing. The thin shoulders were hunched over. This is hunched. Hunched over. The thin shoulders were hunched forward so as to make a cavity of the chest. The scraggy neck seemed to be bending double under the weight of the skull. At a guess, he would have said that it was the body of a man of 60 suffering from some malignant disease. "You have thought sometimes," said O'Brien, "that my face, the face of a member of the inner party, looks old and worn. What do you think of your own face?" He seized Winston's shoulder and spun him around. So he seized, remember, seize takes without permission. He seized Winston's shoulder and spun him around so that he was facing him. This is spin. Spin. Spin, spun, spun. "Look at the condition you're in," he said. "Look at this filthy grime all over your body. Look at the dirt between your toes. Look at that disgusting running sore on your leg." You just wrote the letter E. I'm not sure. Was that a mistake? Did you just accidentally type the letter E? Because I'm not sure what that means. Oh, emaciated, scraggy. So, yeah, emaciated, it means, like, you can see the shape of the skeleton. What? Let's see if we can find a picture of emaciated. Let's look at a dog instead of a person, so it's not so horrible. Well, it's still horrible, but maybe it's easier. So these are emaciated dogs. This is what emaciated means. Scraggy. What happens if we look up a picture of Scraggy? Oh, we get some kind of cartoon character. Every word has become the name of a cartoon character, so sometimes it's really hard to find pictures of things anymore. To me, Scraggy sounds like rough, but let's just take a look here. Thin and not looking healthy. He was wearing a scarf to hide his scraggy neck. So both emaciated and scraggy kind of seem the same, or very similar anyway. Look at the condition you're in, he said. Look at this filthy grime all over your body. Miriam says hello. Hello, Miriam. How are you doing tonight? Or today? This morning? For me, it's 7 a.m. Maybe for you, it's 7 p.m. Look at the dirt between your toes. Look at that disgusting running sore. Do you know when something is running, like if you're sick, if you have a cold and there's something coming, some liquid coming out of your nose, you say, I have a runny nose. You say, I have a runny nose. Miriam's in Bangladesh. So it must be, what time is it? 7 p.m., 8 p.m., something like that, probably. It's nighttime for sure, right? So if you're sick and you have some liquid coming out of your nose, that's a runny nose. That's what you call that, a runny nose. So imagine a running sore, not a bleeding sore, but a running sore. So maybe some kind of liquid coming out, some kind of white liquid coming out of the sore. Could be blood, could be a little bit of blood, but we're not sure what it is, just something coming out. Look at the dirt between your toes. Look at that disgusting running sore on your leg. Do you know that you stink like a goat? Probably you've ceased to notice it. Look at your emaciation. Do you see? I can make my thumb and forefinger meet around your bicep. I can make my thumb and forefinger meet around your... Wait, which one is the bicep? That's a muscle, but I get confused. Biceps and triceps, and I don't remember which one is a bicep. Bicep. Let's find a picture. Okay, yeah, so a bicep is this. This is a bicep. And O'Brien says, I can take my thumb and my forefinger, and they can touch around your bicep. I've lost my place. Do you see? I can make my thumb and forefinger meet round your bicep. I could snap your neck like a carrot. This is snap. But when you take something hard and you do this, like a pencil or a carrot, this would be like snapping a carrot, snapping a pencil. I could snap your neck like a carrot. Do you know that you have lost 25 kilograms since you've been in our hands? Even your hair is coming out in handfuls. Look. He plucked at Winston's head and brought away a tuft of hair. Open your mouth. 9, 10, 11 teeth left. How many had you when you came to us? And the few you have left are dropping out of your head. Look here. He seized one of Winston's remaining front teeth between his powerful thumb and forefinger. A twinge of pain shot through Winston's jaw. O'Brien had wrenched the tooth out by the roots. He tossed it across the cell. Toss is like throw. Miriam says, please tell me where you are from. Well, I'm from the United States, from the Chicago area. That's where I was born. But now I live in Mexico. And Hadi says, it could be pus from the sore, a festering wound. It could be pus. A little bit of pus, a little bit of blood. Maybe just like some clear liquid also. It could be a lot of different things. That's the point of saying a running sore. You don't know exactly what it is, and you don't have to say exactly what it is. It could be anything. We just know liquid is coming out of any color or of all colors. He seized one of Winston's remaining front teeth between his powerful thumb and forefinger. A twinge of pain shot through Winston's jaw. O'Brien had wrenched loose the tooth out by the roots. He tossed it across the cell. You're rotting away, he said. You're falling to pieces. What are you, a bag of filth? Filth means dirt. Now turn around and look into the mirror again. Do you see that thing facing you? This is the last man. If you are a human, that is humanity. Now put your clothes on again. Winston began to dress himself with a slow, stiff movements. Until now, he had not seemed to notice how thin and weak he was. Only one thought stirred in his mind. Remember that stir means move. So only one thought was moving in his mind. That he must have been in this place longer than he imagined. Then suddenly, as he fixed the miserable rags round himself, a feeling of pity for his ruined body overcame him. Before he knew what he was doing, he had collapsed onto a small stool that stood beside the bed and burst into tears. He was aware of his ugliness, his gracelessness, a bundle of bones in filthy underclothes, sitting and weeping in the harsh white light. Weeping is like crying, but crying is just the tears are coming and you're feeling sad, but weeping, you make a lot of noise. So that's the difference. You could cry and not make very much noise, but when you're weeping, it could be very loud. It could be a very loud thing. Oh, by the way, Hadi, you said it could be pus, P-U-S-S, but I think pus is just one S, because P-U-S-S, puss, that usually means like face. And can you hear the difference between the two words? Pus, pus. It has a different vowel sound. And puss, puss is a funny word for face. You've got an ugly puss. It's also short for pussy cat. Like, come here, puss. That could mean like a cat. It will not last forever, he said. You can escape from it whenever you choose. Everything depends on yourself. You did it, sobbed Winston. You reduced me to this state. No, Winston. You reduced yourself to it. This is what you accepted when you set yourself up against the party. It was all contained in that first act. Nothing has happened that you did not foresee. He paused and then went on. We have beaten you, Winston. We have broken you up. You have seen what your body is like. Your mind is in the same state. I do not think there can be much pride left in you. You've been kicked and flogged and insulted. You've screamed with pain. You've rolled on the floor in your own blood and vomit. You have whimpered for mercy. So we've had weeping, which is like very loud crying. And whimpering is very soft crying. That's whimpering. He says whimpering for mercy. So that's like, please, please, please stop like that. That's whimpering. You have betrayed everybody and everything. Can you think of a single degradation that has not happened to you? Winston had stopped weeping. Though the tears were still oozing out of his eyes. And that word oozing, you know, we were talking about the sore, the running sore. So if it says, you know, if you say running sore, you can see the liquid going down. But when you say oozing, it just means it's kind of wet. It's kind of always wet. It's coming out, but in such a slow way that it's just always wet. When you have an oozing sore, you don't see liquid coming down, but if you touch it, it will always be wet. That's what oozing means. So when it says Winston had stopped weeping, though the tears were still oozing out of his eyes, you could imagine there's no tears coming like this. There's no tears coming down, but his eyes are very wet. He looked up at O'Brien. "I have not betrayed Julia," he said. O'Brien looked down at him thoughtfully. "No," he said. "No, that is perfectly true. You have not betrayed Julia." The peculiar reverence for O'Brien, which nothing seemed able to destroy, flooded Winston's heart again. How intelligent, he thought. How intelligent. Never did O'Brien fail to understand what he said to him. Anyone else on earth would have answered promptly that he had betrayed Julia. For what was there that he had not screwed out of him under the torture? He had told them everything he knew about her, her habits, her character, her past life. He had confessed in the most trivial detail everything that had happened at their meetings. All that he had said to her, and she to him, their black market meals, their adulteries, their vague plottings against the party, everything. And yet, in the sense in which he intended the word, he had not betrayed her. He had not stopped loving her. His feelings toward her had remained the same. O'Brien had seen what he had meant without the need for explanation. "Tell me," he said, "how soon will they shoot me?" "It might be a long time," said O'Brien. "You are a difficult case, but don't give up hope. Everyone is cured sooner or later, and in the end, we shall shoot you." Okay, well, that was the end of chapter 3 of part 3 of 1984. I don't think that there maybe is only one or two chapters left. And then we will be finished with the book, which is pretty exciting that we made it all the way to the final part. So next time, hopefully tomorrow morning, we will read chapter 4 of 1984 by George Orwell, part 3. And near the end, okay? But thank you, everyone, who stayed and watched for the entire time. I'm happy to see you here, and I hope to see you for our next reading, okay? But until then, I will see you later. Goodbye.